Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks very much for coming. It's good to see so much interest in this topic. This meeting on the Niger Delta is really part of the Institute's interests on resolving conflicts that are related to Nigeria's governance. Nigeria, as you know, has been instrumental in peacekeeping in the sub-region. For example, with ECOMOG, the peacekeeping force in Liberia, it supplied about 80% of the resources. It is also of great economic potential in West Africa due to its resources, people resources, and natural resources. It's also the largest oil producer on the continent, the 11th largest in the world. So from a U.S. perspective, it's also quite important. So today we're focusing on one of the country's most troubled regions, the Niger Delta. And the Niger Delta is Nigeria's major oil-producing region and has also been the site for egregious human rights abuses, conflict between armed groups, and also great poverty, as many of you know. Most recently, the Niger Delta was in the news because of the Asari incident. He was promoting secession, and the government detained him. USIP has been working in Nigeria since 2003. The Institute's Religion and Peacemaking Initiative has collaborated with the Interfaith Mediation Center in Kaduna, and it's organized a series of training programs. So, and right now it's focused on the strife in Plateau State. So before we hear from Judy Asuni, I want to turn it over to David Smock, who's our director of our Religion and Peacemaking Institute initiative here at the Institute. And he'll tell you a little bit more about what he's been doing in Nigeria. Then we'll hear from Judy Asuni, learn about the peacemaking strategies that are starting to emerge from the Niger Delta, and end with some of your questions and answers. Thanks.
Well, I'll join Darina in welcoming you. Very glad you could join us today for this important presentation. I know you've come to hear Judy Asuni, so I'm not going to spend any time at all talking about what we're doing in Plateau State, aside from mentioning that, as Darina said, we've been partnering with the Interfaith Mediation Center in doing training of young religious leaders from around the continent and also of leaders of religious paramilitary organizations, training them in peacemaking, and more directly involved in Plateau State, mediating a year ago in Yelwa, where the worst of the killings have occurred just a little over 18 months ago, and successfully mediated a peace agreement that has held since then. And our partners at the Interfaith Mediation Center have been working in other parts of Plateau State to carry that same message and the process that worked in Yelwa to try to assure that more violence doesn't break out in Plateau State. We have focused primarily on Plateau State, but one of the really nice things about Judy being here at this time in Washington is that we are wanting to expand and extend our interest in Nigeria to the Delta region. And this will give us an opportunity to learn from her and help us discuss with her ways that we might become more productively involved. Judy is a longtime friend. She has lived in Nigeria for 34 years and is the executive director of Academic Associates Peaceworks, has engaged for many years in important peacemaking activities. In recent years, has focused on the Niger Delta and has become a key player there in trying to bring peace, and she will tell us of her most recent experiences in that regard today. Judy has a PhD from University of Birmingham in sociology and African studies, so brings both a practical on-the-ground experience with peacemaking along with an academic background, and she has lots of interesting things to tell us, and I'll turn it over to her.
Thank you, David and Dorina. It's very nice to be here today. As David said, I'm an old friend of USIP. We actually had a grant from USIP in 1999 to do an intervention in Wari, the inter-ethnic problems in Wari. And we have a book about that, in case you're interested. I can take down a list of people who would like to have copies of that. It's also nice to see some old friends in the audience. Academic Associates Peace Works has an international advisory board, and three of our members are here today. So this is a real cheering team, Susan Collin Marks, and Pauline Baker and John Payton, and I appreciate your presence here. My old friend Deirdre LaPin, we were postgraduate students together back in, what was that, Deirdre, 1970? A long time ago, okay. My sister Carol, who just arrived from Ireland last night, so she's here. And we have a good Nigerian cheering squad, so I'm glad to have all of you here. What I'm going to be talking about today focuses on the Peace and Security Strategy for the Niger Delta, which is a fairly new initiative. But I'd like to start off, first of all, talking briefly about some of the issues in Nigeria and why the Niger Delta is of such great importance. Here's a map of Nigeria. I don't know how many of you are actually familiar with the place, but it's a country about the size of the state of Texas, with a population of something like 120, 130 million people. Nobody really knows, because censuses are tied up with resource allocation. And so people tend to pad the census figures to get more money. So we're not exactly sure how many people there are. In this area, which basically takes about 15 hours to drive to the north, you have about seven different geographical zones, ranging from very dense mangrove rainforest along the coast here, so dense that you cannot penetrate the area. And that's one of the problems of the Niger Delta, because there are very few military facilities and people who are familiar with the area. I lived in three villages for a period of 5 months, and at the end of 5 months, I still don't think I could find my way out if I had to drive a boat to get back to Abonima. So it's very, very dense down here, and you go all the way up to what is effectively the Sahara. You actually find large sand dunes up here just north of Kano. So you have an area that is incredibly diverse geographically. It also has somewhere like 350 or to 450 different ethnic groups. We keep finding more and different groups all the time. It's a country that is right on the corner of West Africa to where it joins the main core of Africa. And so it was influenced, first of all, by the Arab traders coming down across the Sahara. And hence, most of the northern part of the country is Muslim, with pockets of Christianity in various places. The south, in addition to the indigenous religions, you had the European settlers coming up by boat. So you have a high level of Christianity there. Except about 200 years ago, there was an Islamic Jihad and an effort to dip the Quran into the sea. So the Muslims came down from this part, mainly down here, got down to the rainforest where they encountered the tsetse fly. The horses were killed off. But the Europa part of the country is still largely 45% Muslim, 45% Christian. So you get a largely Muslim north. In east, that it still remains largely Christian. And then you have the Europa area that is like half Christian and half Muslim. Those of you familiar with the history of Nigeria know that it gained independence in 1960, has had largely domination by the northerners, although I'm sure John Payton might disagree with me, politically. So you have a number of political alliances here. You may remember that in 1999, Nigeria began a new democratic era. Interestingly, this time with a Yoruba Christian president, which was a fairly new event for the country. And we've had our ups and downs in the last 6 years, but at least we're still going. We're still on track. Nothing has happened in the meantime. Now, the area we're going to be talking about today is largely the Niger Delta. And on the map, the Niger River comes down, starting up here in Mali, joins with the Benue and comes down to form what is one of the few true delta areas in the world. And the delta region of Nigeria is the oil-producing area, which is why it's so terribly important. And it is also, again, a very complex area geographically. I told you about the density of the mangrove rainforest. It's an area that's very difficult to provide commodity facilities such as electricity and water, etc. And it's an area that has been more or less neglected by the government. It's less than 20 years ago that somebody had said the Niger, a top government official had said the Niger Delta will never be important. Now, those of you who were listening to the issues of Asare Dokobo fighting Ateke Tom and the threatened attacks on not only the Nigerian government, but also the oil and gas industry 14 months ago, we realized that the Niger Delta certainly is important to not only Nigeria, but the whole world. The price of oil was zooming upwards as these facilities were being threatened. Now, what has been happening in the last period of time? People say, you know, why is the situation in the Niger Delta so complex? Part of it, I think, is that Nigeria has gone through long periods of military dictatorship where there is, in effect, no good governance. And people in oil companies have actually said to us that they can get away with things in Nigeria that they can't get away with in other countries. And this has led to a number of practices that are not necessarily the most desirable. It's also led to neglect of the area as far as terms of development. And because the government has neglected the area, the brunt has fallen to the oil and gas industry, which, of course, is very unfair and unrealistic. An oil company is not there to provide schools and health facilities and roads and light and water. An oil company is there to extract resources and to market it and to make a profit. So there have been a number of issues in the Delta leading to some of the conflict that has happened in the last few years. Another factor since the new democratic regime in 1999 is that the area has been characterized by bad governance, a high level of corruption. When the state governments began to derive 13% of the oil derivation money, there has been very little accountability and a lot of money has been siphoned off. I'm sure you're all aware that the governor of Bayelsa's state has now been caught in the UK with only £1 million in his pocket. So, I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket. A lot of money has gone in various places. So all of these things lead to a number of problems. Now, a number of young people in particularly River State were used as political thugs for the elections of 2003. And they had all been used by some of the same people until they began to fight each other. And this is something I think we find a lot in armed conflict. Eventually, groups began to splinter and you would develop new dynamics. And this is what was happening in River State. Almost 2 years ago, the two groups led by, on one side, Alhaji Asare Dokobo, who's quite a well-known figure, and Ateke Tom began fighting each other. And as of the end of August 2004, Asare's group was actually within half a kilometer of Government House, ready to attack the governor of River State, who, luckily for him, was not in the country. But over the next period of time, the groups were continuing to fight, and at the very end of September last year, about 300 Ijaw commanders came together and decided that if there was no change, that they were going to attack not only the government, but also the oil installations. And I was in Bonny in, I think this was about March, and one of the guys just casually says to me, oh, we were going to blow up an LNG in November. I mean, this is one of the biggest oil plants in the gas plants in the world, and they were just going to casually blow it up. So there were a number of reasons to take interventions. Finally, at the very end of September 2004, the president invited the two leaders to come to Abuja and to talk to him about what were the issues. And I must say, I've been monitoring some of these issues in River State for a long time. And it was like people in Abuja did not want to believe what was going on. You know, they just didn't want to know about the killings and the political manipulations that were going on. So finally, when the situation got too bad, the president called a halt, invited the two sides to the conflict to Abuja, and a peace declaration was signed on October 1st, 2004, stopping this conflict. Now, I've been working effectively in River State almost full-time for about 9 months, and then I still spend about 3 or 4 days a week in Port Harcourt. And we've been trying to work with the government of River State, trying to bring the situation back under control, while still trying to address some of the fundamental issues in the Niger Delta. One of the things that has come out of this is the peace and security strategy, which I'm going to be presenting to you today. But before I do that, I'd just like to say that when we got to Rivers last October, we spent a lot of time meeting with the different armed groups. These in Nigeria, the definition of youth goes up to the age of 40. So you had a lot of 30-year-olds with very sophisticated weapons. I mean, you would be shocked at the weaponry that these people had. We did case studies. We looked at the different groups that were involved. And there are a number of what you call confraternities. They don't want to be called cults. They want to be called confraternities. These were groups that often started out as kind of innocuous groups in a way. A lot of it could be traced back to 1993, when there were turf battles for the drug trade in Port Harcourt. The trade is actually controlled from Lagos, but there were local skirmishes to try to control the drug trade. And out of these came these, for all intents and purposes, cults. And a lot of them started out like as social groups, as protection groups, sort of what you would see as street gangs in the US. People joined them for protection, for identity, for security, for prestige. And then somehow the whole situation got very violent and began getting involved in increasing levels of armament and violence. And a lot of these groups were used during the 2003 elections as political thugs. So it was when the elections were over, a lot of the politicians began dropping their support for the groups, that there began to be a lot of infighting and power struggles. Some of these same groups also control the oil bunkering business in Nigeria. And interestingly, in the last 14 months, Alhaji Asare also has contracts to provide security services to oil companies and to the Niger Delta Development Commission. Okay, so these are some of the things we're looking at. How can you use the skills of these young men to in more constructive forms of engagement rather than attacking government or oil companies, which I think most of us agree is not a very constructive approach. Okay, over time, we met with the groups, we did case studies, we finally arranged a meeting between the governor and these various groups. We worked with a rehabilitation committee in developing a 30-point action plan as to how these young people could be disarmed, demobilized, and reintegrated back into society. We had some degrees of success. We collected over 3,000 weapons, which were destroyed publicly, and this was monitored by Safer Africa, which is an NGO based in Pretoria. The youth themselves said that they wanted to have a church service because they realized that they had committed sins and they wanted to seek forgiveness. This was an initiative done by the youth themselves. And just before Christmas, we had a church service attended by about 3,000 of the cult members, many of whom came up and confessed their sins and sought forgiveness and tried to look for a different way of life. There was one fellow in the back of the hall who more or less broke down, and he was lying on the floor screaming and saying that he could see the blood of all of the people that he had killed. So, you know, the psychological aspect of seeking forgiveness and sort of cleansing away the past deeds was very important. January, we had a camp, which was supposed to be a mindset change, reorientation camp. And we had planned on 500 people. In the end, 700 people were sent to us in a camp with with very poor facilities, and it was an incredible experience. But it was really the first time that these people from the various sides had come together. And it did help to cause a turning point, helping people to think about that there were different ways of doing things and, you know, how to change their approach. Following the camp, we had a central coordinating committee that was working with the River State government on trying to get training and job creation for these youths. I mean, we're talking about something like 2,000-3,000 members of these armed groups who had put down their weapons and were now looking for alternative jobs. I think we had a good success from October through February, and then some vested interest around the governor came in and tried to control the process himself. And I think this is something that often happens, you know, people feeling that they're not benefiting from a peace process, and so they will try to hijack it. We have had our ups and downs. I think we're back on track again with something called the Facilitators of the River State Peace Process. And this is an interesting group of people. It's sort of co-chaired by the Chief Security Officer and myself, and it contains a representative of the SSS, the Secret Service, the police, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Government Rehabilitation Committee. There's an adolescent program which is run by the governor's wife, and some members of civil society and myself, mainly young people from the Niger Delta. So we've been trying to work on moving along with the demobilization and reintegration activities. Over 2,000 young people have been given technical skills training, but to date there has been no job creation, which is one of the biggest weaknesses. Because after these kids are trained, then there's nothing for them to do. And this is definitely a need that we have. Now, out of the whole process of the last year and a half, we've been thinking about how to approach these issues in a more systematic fashion. And we sat down and looked at what we thought were the major problems facing the Niger Delta as a whole, not just River State. And part of the one's reasons for approaching it as a region was that you do get a lot of influx. You get armed youth members coming this direction, you have arms coming that direction, drugs coming another way. There's a lot of movement, so we really need a comprehensive regional approach. So we undertook research into 10 basic areas: illegal arms importation, oil bunkering, money laundering, disarmament, demobilization and reintegration, reconciliation, corporate practices, the media. What have I left out? Did I say reconciliation? We're going to see it in a minute. Okay. And at our first meeting of the working group, they came up with the issue of governance, that governance, values, and ethics was a very important issue for the Delta. That's interesting. This came from the people themselves. So we have written a series of background papers, and if anybody would like them, I'm quite happy to email you copies of this. I wrote the paper on demobilization and reintegration of youth, and there's a brief summary of what we've been doing in River State. And I hope, an objective analysis of what we did right and what we did not do. So if you would like copies of these, I'd be happy to email it to you. I'm leaving a copy here for USIP. Let's actually do the slide presentation now, Kelly, if you could, so we make it easier. Okay, this is something that we're calling the Niger Delta Peace and Security Blueprint. By the Niger Delta, we started out with rivers, Bayelsa, and Delta states, as these are, number one, the biggest oil-producing areas, and number two, the most conflict-prone areas. Over time, we added a Akwaibom state, and when I went to brief the president in August, he asked us to include Ondo State. So it now includes 5 states in the Niger Delta. Okay, that's okay. The principle here is that when you have very high level of conflict, you also have high levels of poverty or lack of development because of all these issues: oil theft, money laundering, small arms control, and corruption. So our goal is to reduce the level of conflict and build peace and reconciliation while at the same time working on sustainable development. And this, by the way, happens to coincide nicely with what some of the oil and gas companies are doing, like what Deirdre was doing with Shell, what the Terra Group and Chevron are trying to do with them. Okay, thank you. Now, we started out with a past blueprint, which is now developing into a strategy. And we have identified what we think are the key issues. We've worked in the area of disarmament and demobilization. And now we're trying to see how the different stakeholders in the Niger Delta can partner together in promoting peace and development. Okay, thanks. One of the things we find over and over again is that many people look at the manifestations of conflict and react to the manifestations without getting down to the real fundamental problems. We sometimes look at triggers, but it's the roots that we have to get to. And anybody who's been following the issues of the Niger Delta, realizing that the last one, resource revenue distribution, is a very sensitive point for the Niger Delta. Okay, so this is the process so far. We've conducted the research. We've developed the blueprint. We had our first meeting of the Peace and Security Working Group in October, October 8th through 10th. And if you're interested in minutes of that report on that meeting, you can have that as well. We're now in the process of developing the strategy, and I have a fairly detailed strategy if anybody's really interested. You can stay here until 7 or 8 tonight, by the way, if you would like to know all of the strategy. And we hope, starting in January, to be ready for the implementation stage. Thanks. Okay, these are the different programs that we had picked out, so we can see what I managed to miss out. A lot of this started out with the corporate activity idea because, I mean, I'm sure you're all aware of accusations made against oil companies and how they create the conflict in the Niger Delta. They are one of the factors. They are certainly not the only factor. But corporate activity is important. And then the others, oil theft, media, urban youth. Oh, by that we mean drugs and crime, basically. Reconciliation, arms importation, disarmament, demobilization, early warning, money laundering. And the good governance, as I said, was the part added by the working group itself. Now, sorry, can you go back, Kelly? The idea here is that there are three NGOs working on a peace and security secretariat. Those are the International Center for Reconciliation from Coventry Cathedral in the UK. They are the international NGO. The group that I work with, Academic Associates Peaceworks, is a national NGO. And our Niger Delta is a regional NGO made up of young people from the Niger Delta. We are facilitating the working group, the working group being the group that makes the decisions about what happens. And the initial funding has come from NNPC, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, because, of course, that is a government group that coordinates the oil and gas and regulates the oil and gas industry in Nigeria. And they are very interested in making sure that the industry works well, ticks over well. Okay, thank you. Now, the stakeholders are the federal government at various levels, the state governments, corporations, civil society, NDDC, the Niger Delta Development Commission, NNPC, local communities, local governments. And NDDC was set up by the current administration to try to speed up the development of the Niger Delta. So our job is to coordinate the two things, the peace and security by the PAS group and NDDC working on the development angles. Okay, so the Niger Delta PAS working group is to develop a broad coalition to work towards sustainable peace in the Niger Delta and to develop the strategy and also to monitor the implementation thereof. Is it possible for you to put another slide on at the same time? No. Okay, we'll go through this. I must say, we are the blind leading the blind up here, are we? No.
I don't think I can put them up seven.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, let's move through then. We'll go through the working group in a minute. So there's been a discussion as to how does the peace and security group work together with NDDC in a non-conflicting way. And I think that the the agendas are fairly different for each group. But as we always say, peace and development are linked, and each is essential to the other. Now, what has happened in the last year? A lot of the gains that we made in September, October are beginning to slip away. One thing, because demobilization was not well-resourced or sustained. One thing I discovered when reading the literature from other countries is that we, number one, did not have an overall strategy. Number two, did not have a central coordinating group to supervise the demobilization efforts. And number three, that it should have been community-based rather than individual-based. Because when you focus upon some people, then other people become jealous and try to undermine, derail the process. Weapons destruction, we did indeed collect them and destroy them, but there are best practices worldwide, and we need to be following those. Militia strength is growing because the 2007 elections are coming, and we haven't been able yet to demobilize, reintegrate the previous political thugs before new ones are coming up. One of the things that came out of the camp in January was a number of people saying, we were used and dumped. We don't want this to happen to us again. And there's an interesting set of three wise men. They call themselves this. They were former armed group leaders who came together and are preaching against other people being recruited into this. But there are now 14, 15-year-olds who are being recruited as political thugs. And these former group leaders are saying to me, these guys are too young. They don't have good judgment, and they're not well trained in the use of weapons. So there have been people killed randomly on the streets, just in unplanned crossfire kind of thing. So it's a bigger problem, and the elections are coming again, and people are beginning to prepare. International arms dealers, of course, don't want to give up a wonderful market like Nigeria. And very interestingly, some of the members of the armed group have been recruited. One, there was an attempt to recruit some of these guys to overthrow the government of a neighboring country. And just after Christmas last year, December 2004, Alhaji Asare was actually approached by four or five other governors to come and act as mercenaries in their states. There's a big market here. Okay. Good. So these are some of the same issues as I said. The militia groups, if you're very interested in illegal oil theft or bunkering, you'll enjoy the paper in here on oil theft, because it actually tells you how this is done and who benefits and who gets paid what. It's a very big business, and it's very coordinated. Okay. Good. So this is what we have done so far. We've actually accomplished all of those things by this stage. And we had our first meeting of the working group in September 2005. Good. Now, can you click that one that says past working group structure?
The word?
Yeah, that's the one. Thank you. This shows the structure of the working group, and we thought about this very carefully to make sure that all the stakeholders were involved. There's one little omission here. The fifth state has not been added to this one. Basically, the Peace and Security Working Group is made up of a number of key stakeholders. There is the federal government represented by the chairman, who's the Minister of Petroleum Resources. The EFCC, that's the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission. Very interesting. We had two really active members who came to the meeting in September. The NDDC, the Niger Delta Development Commission, that is a federal government initiative. We have three representatives of the security forces, the police, the military, and the SSS. NNPC, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. Then we have the state government levels made up of the deputy governors of the five participating states. We have the oil and gas industry represented by three companies, Shell, Chevron, and AGIP. There are 10 members of civil society who are involved. Across the, at the top, you see only 8 of them, because we took 2 from each of the states. These are representing youth, women, religious organizations, and what we call people's organizations. MOSOP, the John National Congress, other smaller groups as well. And the head of the Traditional Rulers Council and foreign donors. At the moment, EU, and we hope the World Bank will come in. Okay, so those are the people that we perceive, the groups that we perceive as being the key stakeholders in the Niger Delta. Okay, now can you find the action plan, PASS action plan? Mm-hmm. I will go through this very quickly, because if you'd like more details, I'd be happy to send a copy to you. Basically, each of the 3 NGOs is a part of a management group, which also includes a coordinator for the PASS secretariat. And each of the NGOs is responsible for a few programmatic areas. Corporate practices is one that my group, ABW, is responsible for. Let's go quickly. Okay, so we're going to review and identify the current corporate practices that fuel conflict and corruption. And this is not just coming from the outside. Both Shell and Chevron have recently done studies that have indicated the company's role in creating conflict in the Niger Delta. AGIP has just done a review of its organization. So there is an awareness among the companies that there are these issues and that they need to be addressed. Okay? Mm-hmm. The media is a fantastic source of exacerbation of conflict. I'm sure most of you recognize the name of Alhaji Asare Dokubo. Now, he is just one of thousands of people who are fighting in the Niger Delta, but he has made himself a creation of the media because he loves to talk in front of a microphone. And he gets up and rants on and on, often making contradictory statements. I mean, Alhaji's an old friend of mine, so I can say this quite happily. But the media tends to build up whatever is happening because they have to have some press, you know, they have to have some headlines. And for example, after Darina made a comment about Alhaji being arrested in September, and 12 days after he was arrested, Leder Mitie, the head of MOSOP, who most of you connect with the Ogoni struggle, etc., was invited to Abuja to talk with the police. And we were monitoring this very carefully, including the governor, because there's an Ogoni peace process on, and the governor knows that he needs a success story in Ogoni. So Leder Mitie was invited in by the police. He was questioned. He was released. He was never arrested. He was just allowed to go, right? So the next morning, all the news headlines are Leder Mitie arrested by the police and held for questioning. He was never arrested. But that only builds up a lot of the tension, the exacerbation of things. So we're trying to work with how the media reports conflict in the Niger Delta, the effect that their reporting has on this, and how issues of the Delta could be handled in a more sensitive fashion that helps to seek solutions rather than exacerbate the problems. Now, oil theft. This is a very exciting topic. Just to let you have some facts and figures, when oil was like $20 a barrel, the Nigerian government was losing something like $3.7 billion a year. When it got to be $30 a barrel, the Nigerian government was losing over $6 billion a year. What is the price of oil today? It's in the 60s, isn't it? Exactly. So you can imagine how much the Nigerian government is losing at this moment. And not only that, but the oil companies, at $30, they were losing about $320 million a year. So oil theft is a very big business. And from what we can see, there are some top government officials, and particularly retired military officers, who are actively involved in this. The people of the Niger Delta themselves, the youths are often involved with actually tapping the lines and putting the crude into barges. but it's a very big business, including Russians, Lebanese, French, all sorts of things. The illegal oil going to markets in Rotterdam, for example, or private refineries in Côte d'Ivoire. So it's not the people in the Niger Delta who are benefiting from this business. It's a lot of other people. Okay, so the oil theft activity will be largely based abroad, trying to dry up the oils for the illegal crude, and also trying to plan campaigns to international campaigns to reduce it. As well, there'll be campaigns and awareness in Nigeria itself. But again, if you want to get the guys to stop tapping the pipelines, you have to have an alternative source of income for them. Okay. All right, that's all about that. No, that's okay. I think if anybody's really interested, they can get a copy of the action plan. Okay. Reconciliation process. The Ogoni reconciliation is going to be one of the first steps. President Obasanjo has appointed Father Matthew Kuka, who I think is a fairly well-known social activist, to head the Ogoni reconciliation process, and some of us are helping to support him on the ground. Then the whole idea of using reconciliation in other areas of the Niger Delta as well. And that is a strength, obviously, of the International Center for Reconciliation. Illegal arms importation. Okay, again, an international campaign trying to work with some of the agencies in controlling the influx of weapons into Nigeria. And what you find often is that the bodies that are in charge of controlling arms importation don't talk to each other. They don't share information. So the idea of PASS is to try to coordinate some of these activities. Okay? No, that's okay. Again, we'll be looking at a comprehensive disarmament program according to global best practice and helping to get support from various other groups for this. This is my favorite, so we'll spend more time on this. Like I said, in reading the literature, we found what we should have done. And so I think we can help to other governments, other places that are trying to demobilize members of armed groups. For example, Delta State, the Ijaws and the Shikiris had very large fighting groups and sophisticated weapons as well. And these people have never been disarmed and never demobilized. So that is just a disaster waiting to happen for anybody who wants to buy them off for the next election, for example, or hire them out as mercenaries. So part of our idea is to develop a comprehensive demobilization package and keep going. That's fine, thank you. And also to work with governments and companies and foreign donors on reintegration. And by this we mean meaningful job creation, meaningful activities in getting them back integrated into their communities in particular. And Nigeria is still a very community-based country. You know, like the Okrikas identify as being Okrikas. The Kalabaris identify as being Kalabaris. So there can be social controls within their own ethnic groups that help to hold this. It's not a fractured society like the U.S. where you don't have a particular place that you still align to. In Nigeria, people still very much identify with their home communities. Okay, youth development, leadership training. I mean, these are things, mindset change, different ways of doing things. Human capital development. This is one thing we found, that you have to find out who these people are, why they join various groups, what they are looking for in the groups, and what alternatives there can be. Okay. Lots of activities here. Okay, and with this we'll be working with the Niger Delta Development Commission because they have the money for doing these kind of activities. And also thinking about how we can work with the oil and gas companies, for example, in developing leadership skills. We were talking earlier with Chevron about how the community-based MOUs, Memorandum of Understanding, can help youth develop their own leadership skills to take an active role in planning the development for their communities. This is something we need a lot of help, though. And like the State Department and the commercial groups, we need serious investment in Nigeria, not these token little things. Nobody's happy with the equivalent of $100 a month in a token job. People want something that will really give them a sense of satisfaction as well as a financial stability. Okay. Now, an early warning system. This is something that we've talked about for years. We talked with the government about setting up an early warning system, but to date, nothing has actually been happening. And I think there's an international interest in helping Nigeria to do this. I think it's okay. A lot of work in early warning, as you can see. Okay? We have speed readers here. Okay, money laundering is another thing in which there's been a fair amount of interest. For example, Global Witness has been tracing where money has been invested. And that is one of the ways that they managed to track down Dariye and Alamese, two governors who have been arrested in the UK for money laundering. And this is a thing that groups outside of Nigeria can help us with. Where does this money go, and how can we get it back, and to help with the government? I think you know the Swiss government finally returned millions of dollars of the Abacha money, but it took years. But we need help in these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Okay, this was the last subject that was put in by the people themselves, because they realized that there has been a breakdown of the social structure in the Niger Delta. And we're still developing ideas about how good governance can be promoted, but I think it's a very fundamental thing. If we're ever going to have any development, there has to have some accountability to citizens and people taking an active role in planning their own development, because then you have a sense of ownership. We made a comment this morning that Chevron hospitals have been burned down several times. Every time that there's an ethnic unrest, they burn down a Chevron hospital. Okay, but if it's your hospital, you're not going to burn it down, you know? Okay. All right. And there you go. I think I've talked enough. I would love to have some questions. Let me just, before we go on that, though, I'd just like to say that peace and security strategy is something that's evolving. Like I said, at our first working group, they came up with the issue of governance. At the next meeting in a couple of weeks, we're going to be presenting them with the action plan. We've talked to a number of groups all over the world, people in the State Department, people in the World Bank. And we're very interested in developing partnerships with people who can provide us with the expertise and, of course, the funding for working on some of these things. Like, for example, the World Bank is interested in demobilization and reintegration of youth. DFID is quite interested in the whole issue of arms importation and disarmament. So we need as much help as possible. I think this is a fairly new idea. It's something that's never happened before, of government and oil companies and civil society trying to work together to develop a comprehensive approach. So I hope that I've stimulated your interest today, and maybe we'll get lots of volunteers to come and help us develop the thing. Thank you very much. I think I'll stop here. Now, Francis is from Odi. Do you remember what happened in Odi in the early days of the current administration? What happened, Francis?
Odi was totally destroyed.
Exactly. So Odi has a long way to go in redevelopment. Okay, what would you like to say?
Well, first of all, I want to say you were very comprehensive and very experienced and knowledgeable with what you just said, because it's just like saying what I would have said if I was to say that.
Why don't you turn so those in the back can hear you?
There's a microphone over here.
The mic here.
Well, first of all,
yeah, it's on.
Okay. First of all, my name is Francis Udisi, and as she rightly said, Judy rightly said, I'm from OD, and OD in 1999 was destroyed by the present government for the simple reason that we were accused of, OD rather, the residents of OD were accused of harboring people that were involved in criminal activity. It had nothing to do with oil. They just went in there with military arms and heavy firearms or whatever, and went and destroyed every single building in the town. Anyway, that is a long story. What I want to say is that from what she said, I am very, very impressed, because she really rounded up a lot. But I believe with time limitation, she couldn't go further. But I'm very impressed because, you know, I mean, it's just very impressive. Having said that, I want to add one or two things. You know, you mentioned about job creation and the mobilization. First of all, there are two things. You see, I'm 45, and I grew up in that community before coming here at the age of 17, and I've been here ever since. Now, when we talk about job, 99.9% of the job in the Niger Delta are not by the people from the Niger Delta, and I believe you know that. Now, if somebody is coming to United States and take all the good job, well-paid job, you will react. And that is the main reason, one of the main reasons of the conflict in the Niger Delta. People are not fighting to destroy oil well. Even as Sari, look at what he says daily. Even though as conflicting as you may have said it, his main objective is job creation, provision of amenities. Secondly, is this corruption by our leaders. They are part of the main problem. We're not fighting because of the oil. We're fighting because of provision of amenities, provision of jobs, good living. We want to live like United States. Why am I here? I shouldn't be here. Nigeria produced so much oil. Why am I here? That is the question we should ask ourselves. I should be living like people in Kuwait. Yes. So that is the crux of the issue. And now, for us to get those jobs created, the oil companies should be held accountable. They should be held to give a percentage of those jobs to those people from that particular area, if they really want to solve that problem, because they are part of the problem. Actually, they are a major part of the problem. And that is why it makes it look like it's oil. It's not really oil, although oil is good that we have them. But the problem is the way and manner these oil companies control this job, give it to people that, as you rightly said, from outside. You know, you pointed that out, that the jobs and the bunkering and all that benefit outsiders. Why the people there? Of course they will fight back, you know, and they are agitating because of that. And then, again, you talk about arms. Now, when you talk about arms are manufactured not in Africa. They are manufactured somewhere else. Why don't you go to those people manufacturing the arms and tell them, we don't want your arms to go to Niger Delta? Why tell Niger Delta to stop using the arms? How did they get it? Somebody sold it to them, shipped it, and some government allowed it to get there. I can't send anything to Nigeria. I send books, medical equipment, under Earthright Institute to Nigeria, and they are scrutinized. They are inspected. They are, you know, done everything to make sure that they are legal. And that is book. We're talking about harm. Who shipped them? Somebody did. Mm-hmm. Why don't you go after those people? Why Niger Delta? So that is where the problem will start. Go after the makers, the manufacturers, the shippers, the buyers, or the seller, rather, from this side. Because we don't make harm. We can make harms. We don't have the technology to do it. That is how we can solve that harm issue. It's not from that. Those people don't know. If it breaks down, they dump it and want to buy a new one. So who is the person supplying it? Those are the issues we should face. So, you know, I can go forever.
Okay, let me... I think we should stop with you, Francis, so we can allow some...
Yes.
Thank you very much. Let me give a bit of information, though. A year and a half ago, we did a workshop for Niger Delta youth that was sponsored by NNPC. And out of that came a standing committee on Niger Delta youth, which includes 4 youth members and 3 oil companies and NNPC. And I must say, our very first time of sitting down with people like Oronto Douglas, who I think his name is well known in Nigerian circles, and people from Shell, it was quite a hot topic. But we eventually developed a roadmap, one point of which, and this is a very sore point, of course, as Francis said, is the non-employment of Niger Delta indigens by the companies. So it's been agreed that 25% of management positions and 67% of workforce positions will go to Niger Delta indigens, and that the NNPC is responsible for monitoring that and making sure that the oil and gas companies actually follow through on that. Another aspect is to develop like the Shell SITP program, where you give special enforcement capacity building for people from the Niger Delta to build them up to be able to obtain the management positions. Okay? So that's one initiative. What I found in all of this is that people know that things have to change, but they don't necessarily know how to do it. You know, and the companies knew this, the government knew this, the people of the Delta knew this, that things were not right, but they didn't know exactly how to go about doing it. And that's one of the nice things about bringing all the stakeholders to the table, to get a synergy of ideas and to get people working together. Yes, we had a question here.
Will you come up to the microphone, please?
And can you introduce yourself, too?
Thank you very much. I'm Don Shirk with the Center of International Private Enterprise. I enjoyed your remarks very much, but I was puzzled by the omission of 2 concepts which frequently make it into the press, but for some reason you felt they weren't important enough to mention. One is publish what you pay.
Okay.
The second is USAID.
Who do we have from USAID here? Okay, fine. A little hand. Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, the publish what you pay is an important initiative, as is the EITI, the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative. And those are 2 of the things that we're supposed to be working with on the corporate practices thing. You're absolutely right. You say it. You mean with Shell? USAID and Shell? Yeah, okay. Shell is working, USAID is working with Shell and an agricultural institute on several initiatives. One is a cassava farming project. The oil and gas industry is very labor unintensive, and so there are very few jobs available to people in the oil and gas industry. Once something is built, you know, it takes very few people to actually maintain it. So we need a lot of alternative sources of employment for the people in the Niger Delta. And because of the insecurity or the perceived insecurity, people are reluctant to go there. Since the problems in Wari started in 1997, but particularly again in 1999, there was a crisis, and then again in 2003, when there were major shutdowns of both Chevron and Shell, every single one but one fabrication industry moved out of Wari to Port Harcourt. So, I mean, this is a very chicken and egg kind of situation. You know, how can you have stability and security and development unless you have jobs? And how can you have jobs unless you have that? One problem I found with USAID is that sometimes the programs get very rigid and locked in ahead of time. When we were working with these thousands of young people last year, I went to almost all the foreign donors that I could think of for help in training and job creation, and there was almost nothing available. They said, okay, we have long-term projects. We don't have the flexibility of just diverting money to something. Although the head of USAID did sit down with us a few months ago, and he said, I really want to talk about jobs with you, because jobs, I think, is a big part of it. You know, getting people constructively re-engaged in their society is very important. Because it's not just the money, it's also the psychological welfare and stability.
Well, now, I'll take three or four questions and then Judy can respond. And
how about this one back here? And then Deirdre, and then, okay, one, two, three, four, okay?
Good afternoon. My name is Emmanuel Kuti. Judy invited me here. There's one thing that you omitted that is very important in the Niger Delta. My wife is from the from Wari, so mm-hmm. I'm quite knowledgeable about the area. That's the environmental impact of digging oil, you know, doing everything with oil. Because if you go to Niger Delta, you know it's very filthy, full of oil. All the streams are oil polluted and everything. Nothing was done. Maybe that's one aspect of where they can engage the youths in helping with this with the system, because I too personally believe that the oil company are not doing enough. We know our government are not going to do enough. They give money to the chiefs, to the leaders, but they don't spread the money enough to the youths. And in your slide also, you mentioned affirmative action plan. You know, in this country, affirmative action is totally different. You know, they talk about affirmative action. I think you talk about affirmative action, that's about training the youths, getting them jobs. Training is okay, but getting them job is another issue. Okay. So maybe we need to look at other things to put in there to be able to engage them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Emmanuel. Deirdre?
Hi. I'm Deirdre LePin. Judy, I think you've done a remarkable job of very succinctly describing a very complex situation. I'm wondering, for some members of the audience, they might be puzzled by this relationship between cult groups and politicians. I mean, what do these youths actually do with their arms? What is the motive? Obviously, the politicians perceive this as a job, as Francis was saying. Youth are looking for a job, but for the youth, it also is more than that. So that was one idea that came to my mind that might help explain a bit this very complex problem. And the other question I have about jobs is, reference is made and has been made for many years in the Niger Delta about the lack of infrastructure. And we have many unemployed, unskilled youths who are being trained in certain skills, many of which bear on construction or technical skills. Now, has there been any serious effort to bring together the tremendous development needs, particularly in infrastructure, of the Niger Delta, and this great wealth of energy that exists but which needs better direction? I mean, could we think of some kind of works program for the Niger Delta as Roosevelt conceived during the WPA? Is that idea on the table?
Okay. Okay, thank you.
I am not going to be asking questions. I am going to be making comments.
Just briefly.
I'll try and be brief. Let me first of all, by the way, my name is Omar. I am the president of Biafra National Union here in Washington, D.C. My appearance here is kind of impromptu because I was just told at the last minute about this conference. So I decided to come up here to see what is going on. Let me also say that I am deeply appreciate your work, you and your organizations, about the what is going on in Niger Delta, actually the whole of the East, because Niger Delta is part of the East. And when you're talking about Niger Delta without mentioning Igbo also, then something is wrong with the picture. And when you are describing Nigeria as you did, which is really nice, which I also appreciate, without maybe tracing back the original conflict of the present situation now. Like I said, either you were told to omit certain facts or design, I don't know. And I'm sure a lot of people here are grown-ups who are aware of the Biafra-Nigerian conflict that was between 1967 and 1970. Let nobody forget that. You should not forget that, because this is part of the problem today. And I hate to go in different directions. Like I said, you have done a very good job. And I want you to continue doing your job. But let me say the fact, and let me say the truth. Statistics show that the entity called Nigeria does not literally exist. It's a false country, you know, formed under false pretense, under false pretense. So the bottom line is that the entity called Nigeria is doomed. It's not going to stand, and I will ask you to mark my word today, because it's going to happen. Yes, we have been asking for peace. We have been crying. We have been crying over the years. Anybody whipped right through the floor can do nothing but cry. We have cried so many years for help. And we have been pursuing peace, peaceful negotiations to the entity called Nigeria. And that is peaceful dissolution of that entity. Because like you pointed out, there are more than 300 ethnic groups in Nigeria that has nothing whatsoever in common. And that has been one of the major problems. Why, after the 1914 amalgamation of the entity called Nigeria, that still today is a problem. So let's be truthful. Let's be honest. Because eventually, when you whip a dead horse is not going to get up any day. This is the same thing with Nigeria. Nigeria, any way you cut it, dice it, slice it, Nigeria is dead. We need your help. We need your help to help us dissolve Nigeria so that different ethnic groups can go their different way as enriched in the United Nations Charter, as well as anybody else who loves peace.
Okay.
So I would want you to please work towards peace, peaceful dissolution of the entity called Nigeria. Thank you.
Okay, let me respond to a couple of questions as for David's. I'd just like to make one clarification. A reference was made to Alhaji Asare Dokubo making a comment about calling for the disintegration of Nigeria. And I've been working closely with his lawyers on the issue, because the first charges against him that came out at the end of September included treasonous activities during the amnesty period that was covered by the amnesty that the president gave last year. That has now been changed to make reference to only activities after 1st of October. And his lawyers make it very clear to say that he has not called for the disintegration of Nigeria. He has said that if the Nigerian people come together and decide they do not want to stay together as a country, then he will support that. Okay? So I think there's quite a variation of opinion across the board, everywhere from Omar, who says that we should break up Nigeria as a whole, to other countries that say that Nigeria must, other people that say that Nigeria must stay as a whole. But just a clarification about the Alhaji Asare issue. By the way, he comes up to court again on November 10th. And I understand that he's currently on a hunger strike because he was moved from the police inspector general's guest house to some other prison or something. Anyway, that comes up on November 10th, so you'll want to keep an eye on what's going on there. I wanted to talk a bit about the cults and political violence issue. As I said, a number of people joined cults as like street gangs or for security. And one of my favorite people was saying that last August, about 6 weeks before the violence was halted, he stopped and he thought to himself, what am I doing here? I joined a cult when I was 14 years old because I would go to parties and somebody would steal my hat or my shoes. And so I joined a cult to have a brotherhood. You know, we'd go to parties together. And somehow it had become this vicious cycle of violence. And a lot of these cults were armed and then hired by politicians to rig the elections. Some of this happened in 1999, but a lot of it massively in 2003. Intimidation. I mean, there have been killings and political assassinations. Marshall Harry was a friend of mine. I have since heard a number of people confirm the group of people who killed him, politically assassinated him before the elections. So there has been not only intimidation, but for example, we had NDI had a group monitoring the elections in Port Harcourt, and one of my staff members was right across the board, and she said all of a sudden they heard the shooting, and a bunch of police came in and took over the polling booth and chased away all the voters. There are other cases of people who sat in stuffed whole ballot boxes in their houses and their offices and things like this. River State supposedly had a 97% turnout in the 2003 elections, out of which about 97% voted for Governor Odeley. And only 60,000 votes were cast by the opponent. Now, I mean, he's got 60,000 members of his immediate family. So after the elections, he came to me and he said, a guy called Sarge Owuse, who was sort of viewed as being quite brutish and thuggish, and he said, Judy, you know, you asked me to not use violence, and I didn't, and look what happened. So what do we do next? And I said, okay, well, let's link you up with the Independent Electoral Commission. And we did, and they gave him specific evidence that there's no way that 97% of the votes could have been cast because only 50% of the voters' cards had been collected. So there was eventually an election tribunal, and they sat and they said that it was a fair election, in spite of, you know, evidence to the contrary. So this is all things that we need to work at for the next time around to make sure that this doesn't happen. And if you have any good ideas, let us know. Because, of course, right now, primaries for PDP will be one of the major opportunities for violence rather than the election itself. If the current situation continues, whoever wins a PDP nomination will just go in automatically. There won't be any real election. Deirdre had mentioned this whole idea of a works program years ago, and I really wish we had pursued it. It was funny because somebody was saying this the other day, what about a massive employment opportunity for people to get jobs? And I think if there are reasonable salaries, people will go. You know, people say the use of the Niger Delta are uncontrollable. And I think that those of us who have been working on the process for 13 months now will say maybe there's 20% of people who are irredeemable. But a lot of other guys just want some meaningful employment, and they want a role to play. They got into things by accident, and they want alternatives, and it's our job to provide them with the alternatives. Okay, we had another question back there, and then we had a question here. Okay. Would you take some of those newsletters so people might collect them on the way out if they have to leave? Thanks.
Yes, my name is Abisebi Godi. I'm from Bayelsa State as well, just like Francis.
You know? Okay.
We have apparently been classmates. We all came to the States the same time, literally almost. You know, I'm the president of Bayelsa Professional Group. This is a group founded here for the purpose of trying to work with organizations to try and enlighten people and enlighten the community back in Bayelsa State. And by the way, before I go into that, I would, in your comment, you said you have difficulty going into the swamp area in Bayelsa State. I will tell you from Brass, a place called Brass in Bayelsa State. I'm giving you an open invitation. You guys should come to Brass. Brass is a very quiet place. It's a peaceful place in Bayelsa State, you know. So I need to make that comment. You know, okay. Now what we are trying to do here is to work up, you know, it's a very, very interesting story that you just said that the oil companies are giving opportunity about 25% available to the Niger Delta used for them to get employment and so on. I think that's a very good area that we'll be very much interested in working with the organization to try and see, because as we speak, we have a lot of graduates who are engineers, professionals, and they still can't get job in the Niger Delta in these oil companies. So we are trying to work with an organization to try and see how we could be able to put these people, because leadership is very important, but if you don't have your people who are in leadership, any other thing else will not be possible for other youth to, because they keep saying, I say, you have got out of university, you have your master's in engineering, you don't have a job from the oil company. And if they give you a job, they give it to you as a contract staff in your own community. So basically, these are the areas we are trying to work with NGOs, mm-hmm. as an NGO, trying to work with the organization to try and promote that. And I will also just quickly comment that the president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, have made a tremendous effort in trying to put forward, in terms of funding for the Niger Delta. There is even an increment in 30% derivation to the states, but it's just a matter of mismanagement that has been the key problem in this area in the community. So if the proper governance, proper direction is given, I think everybody will be able to benefit in the state. You know, that's basically the point I want to make. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Yes, in the front row, do you want to speak? Yes.
Thank you also for your excellent presentation. I'm Alana Hartsock, Earth Rights Institute, co-director, working closely with Francis here. Our involvement and engagement in Bayelsa State in the Niger Delta really began through an international network of economic justice people who understood how the Alaska Permanent Fund as a transparent resource rent fund could be a very useful type of model for transparency and resource rents for the Niger Delta area. And we had been putting together a brief proposal for an international conference on the Niger Delta Fund Initiative, we call it. So I would like to put forth a call today to form some sort of coalition or network that we can move forward on this plan to have along the lines of the good governance of the clear resource rents, transparency, what the corporations publish, what you pay, extractive resource initiative, transparency initiative, to have an actual conference there with the states that you're working with and international teams of experts to really set up transparent resource rent fund. So I'd like to continue that dialogue with whoever might be interested.
Okay. Thank you, Alana. What is this Bayelsa mafia here? We seem to have a real Bayelsa network. That's good. Yes. We don't have anybody from the other Delta states?
Michael Enders, I am the regional advisor for West Africa and USAID, and since the name of my agency was taken, I just thought I'd come in. I don't want to talk specifically about our program in Nigeria. We have a mission directory, and we're a very decentralized group, and mission directors essentially control it. I just want to know that we have at the moment a high-level Nigerian government delegation in town, and there are major meetings going on between them and the U.S. government, mm-hmm. USAID being a part of this, exploring a whole lot of issues, including the Niger Delta, and looking for different ways of cooperation, collaboration, mm-hmm. and changing mm-hmm. the rules of the game. I just say that it is something that the U.S. government is concerned about, among many things that we're concerned about, and there are definitely discussions underway as we speak here mm-hmm. at the government-to-government level. So that's all. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Let me just add, too, that the World Bank is thinking about putting some serious effort into the Niger Delta. And UNDP is just hiring a conflict specialist for the first time ever in Nigeria. So I think there's a budding awareness among donors. You know, the Niger Delta has been considered a very difficult place to work. And people have been reluctant to go there and to work. So I'm glad to see that there's an interest in people coming in. Any other questions or comments? Francis, you've spoken once. Yes, in the very back?
I was just wondering, Felicity Nelson Greenhouse, you mentioned that good governance is actually something that it was the first thing that came out of the first meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering why it wasn't one of the topics that you initially thought of when you listed
guess maybe we took it for granted that governance was always an issue, and you keep seeing transparency and accountability and all these other things. I don't know why per se. I think we just never demarcated it as a specific issue. But it's a huge problem, of course, in Nigeria. And a year ago, the president had come up with the idea of community committees, where he wanted each ethnic community to put together a unit to think about how to redevelop their ethnic group. I mean, most of these groups are Ijaw, but the Okrika to develop something for their Okrika kingdom, and the Kalabaris to do something for their kingdom, and the Ogbakaris that are actually a Kwiri, it's a non-Ijaw ethnic group, to do something for that. And nothing has happened, but I think we're finally moving back to that again. Like so many of the things in Nigeria, implementation is a problem. There's just often not follow-up. Good ideas, people are told to do something, but then they don't get around to doing it. But I think the whole idea of working together in a conscious way to try to rebuild community governance is an excellent approach, because it's where you have accountability right on the ground, you know? Who is controlling young people who get out of line? Who is controlling traditional rulers or elders who chop all the money from the oil companies, things like this? Any other questions or comments? Now, who's going to stay until 8 o'clock tonight to go through every step of our strategic plan? Do we have any volunteers? My sister will have to stay. She's going home with me. So. Any other comment? Francis, do you want to make one?
Yes.
Is that okay to have one more comment
briefly.
From them?
Yes, briefly. I believe you are hearing my voice. I want to add that I'm working with U.S. Institute for United States Army Corps of Engineers. Army Corps of Engineers in association, kind of, perhaps, probably under the sponsorship of USAID, to do some engineering work in Bayelsa as a peace and homeland security initiative. Because, as I initially said, with peace in an environment, there will be peace here also in the United States. If there is peace in the Niger Delta, there will be peace here, and there will be peace everywhere, because it's collective effort. Now, the project is sound feeling, because as she said, rightly pointed, that Bayelsa is, or Niger Delta is one of the most difficult environment in the world to work in. And therefore, we're trying to help Bayelsa to subsidize the cost of land reclamation through the Army Corps of Engineers. So we're still working on the project. That is one peace initiative. And then other area that I would like to add is for collective effort in massive power production. Mm-hmm. Because without power, you can't even start any industry. There will be no employment if there is no industry. So while USAID is working with Nigerian government, Shell, NNPC, we should think about power. I wrote to the Minister of Science and Technology, who incidentally from
town.
You know, from my town. So I have access to the right to talk to him. So I mentioned to him that anything else he's doing is wishful thinking, unless there is electricity, constant electricity. He wrote back. I thought he wasn't going to reply, maybe look at it as something rude, but he responded that the government is working on power production. But I told him that what they are proposing so far is not even 20% of what New York consumes. So we have to look into that. Why are you proposing that we should talk about power production? Without power production, we are not getting anything.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Kelly, can you make sure people get the newsletter? The newsletter from Academic Associates PeaceWorks is on the table out here, and I've already read a copy, and it's very interesting, and it illuminates some of the things that Judy mentioned in her presentation. I just want to thank Judy. I'm sure all of you are as grateful as I am for her presence here today and for the very thoughtful and comprehensive presentation, but more than that, more than for the presentation, is what she's doing and attempting to accomplish in Nigeria. So thank you, Judy. And thank you all for coming today.